You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Boy, did the Supreme Court... It was one of those Dewey beats Truman moments for CNN and many of the other networks.
We find that under the Commerce Clause, this would not be constitutional. But
David Lyle is on the line with us. He is the director and senior counsel of Courts Matter, part of Media Matters for America, MediaMatters.org, the website. An expert on the Constitution for 10 years, served as the deputy director of the American Constitution Society for Law and Policy. And welcome to our program, David.
It's great to be with you, Tom.
Thank you for joining us. You want to give us a snapshot of what happened this morning, or what the decision was, rather?
Well, I mean, the very simplest version is that the Affordable Care Act was upheld.
Mm-hmm.
Not in the way a lot of people had anticipated. The court did say, a majority of the court, the five conservative justices, which still includes Chief Justice Roberts, who is extremely conservative, did say that the act would be invalid if the only support for it were the Commerce Clause, but Chief Justice Roberts joined with the four more progressive justices to say that there was a constitutional basis for the act in Congress's tax power.
Which is probably why Messrs. Scalia and Alito a few days ago were so grumpy on the bench. Maybe
they could have known what was coming.
Yeah, it may well be. Your thoughts on the rationale? I mean, the Obama administration went out of their way not to argue, although they did it once in a lower court, that it was a tax. But generally speaking, not to argue that this was a tax. They didn't want to acknowledge that it was politically dynamite, and Romney is using that right now. And it seems like Justice Roberts did in this case something similar to what he did in Citizens United, which is going beyond the scope of the original arguments to find a rationale or an explanation. Is that, do you think, an accurate analysis? And B, if so, why did he do that? Could it be that the court has gotten such a bad reputation since Bush v. Gore and Citizens United that he's concerned about his legacy?
Well, I think on the tax issue, you know, that is something that the administration had pretty consistently argued in court. Now, you're right. In the campaign and in some of their public pronouncements, political figures in the administration had stayed away from the tax label. But in the litigation, the administration had been pretty consistent in saying that the tax power was an alternative reason to uphold the law.
They had, including before the Supreme Court.
That's right.
I didn't realize that.
It was very much part of the arguments before the court. And in fact, I mean, that's what's really been kind of silly about the whole thing already. I mean, all along with the, you know, the superheated rhetoric about the death of freedom in America, all the mandate has ever been about, it was not that you would be arrested and put in jail, you would be taken out and beaten if you didn't have health insurance. All it ever was this very modest tax penalty that if people have the money to pay for insurance, choose not to pay for it, then they would be subject to a modest penalty capped at 2.5% of income. That's all this has ever been about. So I think it's completely appropriate that it was upheld under the tax power.
So 2.5% of income could be a big deal for Mitt Romney or the Koch brothers if they decided not to buy insurance on principle.
That's true. That's true. They'll have a tough decision to make. Although I suspect they, rich as they are, I suspect they have pretty good health insurance.
Yeah, I'm guessing you're absolutely right. How do you have a tax for which there's no enforcement mechanism?
Well, I think it'll be enforced by the IRS. So people, I think it'll be deducted from refunds of people, is my understanding. I'm not an expert on that part of the implementation, but I think it'll be administered just like any other tax.
Okay. And then Medicaid. Medicaid is the joint federal-state program to provide for poor people in the states and people who work at Walmart, people whose income is below a certain threshold. And the states under the Obamacare as written, if I understand this correctly, if the states did not take federal funds and then matching amounts from their own revenues to expand their Medicaid program, then they would lose all of the federal funds. They'd lose their entire Medicaid program, which would be disastrous politically for a state. If they could just cap it where it is right now, though, which I believe Scott Walker's already said he intends to do in Wisconsin, then, you know, there's not so much of a political fallout. And that's what the Supreme Court has allowed. Is that correct?
That's right. That's right. States will, I think there's still a little bit of uncertainty as to how these things are going to play out. But I believe what the way most people understand it now is states will have a choice to either participate in the Medicaid expansion or not. If they do choose to participate, they can't take that money and spend it on something else, either another kind of healthcare program or a non-healthcare program. They have to implement the Medicaid expansion just as the Affordable Care Act requires, but they do have the choice not to participate in the expansion at all, and they don't risk losing, as you said, the rest of their Medicaid funding.
Right.
And I think it's a real open question how that's going to play out politically. I think probably different ways in different states. Some states will be very eager, I think, to obtain the additional funding and provide additional coverage. I think probably in some states, the political elite will decide that it wants to score some kind of political point about standing up to the administration, and will refuse the money and, you know, pass up an opportunity to help a lot of people in the state. And in other states, there will be a battle about which of those two courses to follow.
Yeah. Well, after all, it's just poor people being hurt, right? I mean, that seems to be the Republican rationale these days. But doesn't this run the risk in a way of producing the same kind of problem, which is still a real problem, but it's been somewhat ameliorated by federal educational assistance, of because education typically was locally funded and then backstopped by state funds, that if you were not a member of the Lucky Sperm Club, if you were born into a really poor area of Appalachia or some, you know, urban part of America, your schools were terrible. Whereas if you were born into, you know, an affluent community, you know, just coincidence of fate, you could go to very good schools. And so we're trying to equalize that with the federal education grants and standards. Isn't this sort of the healthcare for the poor equivalent of that?
Well,
couldn't that kind of outcome be produced by this?
Well, I think that's right. I think that's what the act was originally trying to avoid by expanding Medicaid everywhere for everyone. And I suspect you're right. I think the states that are doing the worst job now of providing coverage for their people are probably going to be the first to get in line to again try to score the political point. So it's certainly that's not part of the happy news from today.
Yeah. Now, is this the sort of presumably this is the sort of thing Congress could easily revisit were it inclined? Now, you know, it would take a House of Representatives not owned by the Tea Party, but that would be the solution, would it not?
I think that's right. There's ways of working around it. If, as you say, the political will is there at the federal level, there are a couple of the way the court tweaked the Medicaid part, which is under Congress's spending power, and also the vote by the five justices, including Chief Justice Roberts, to say that the mandate would not have been valid under the Commerce Clause. Those are two very potentially very significant and potentially extremely worrisome changes to the law that we're just going to have to wait and see what the justices do with them. But those could cause real problems down the road.
Yeah. Well, we will. Yeah. Keep an eye on this very closely. David Lyle, MediaMatters.org. David, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
And for the very lucid and cogent explanation. Much appreciated. We'll be back 16 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So what are the consequences? What are the political consequences of this? We've been talking about the health. Well, actually, what are the healthcare consequences, too? We'll cover all that in just a minute. Welcome back. By the way, as we go through the day here, Congressman Jan Schakowsky is going to drop by. Congressman Ted Deutsch is going to drop by. And I've got a couple of rants I want to share with you. One about the Supreme Court and one about Fast and Furious, what the Republicans are up to. And, I mean, you know, some genuinely bizarre stuff going on. And so, you know, we'll get into those, too, as we continue through the day. Also, yeah, you probably noticed, I'm sure you've heard by now, that the CNN, Fox, some of the other big networks got it wrong at the very beginning. It was this, you know, Dewey beats Truman moment, because the when John Roberts read his ruling, he said essentially, we can't find a constitutional basis for this. Well, actually, Shano is with us, and Shano was there in the Supreme Court this morning. Welcome, Shano.
Good to be here.
Our associate producer and Talk Radio News' Supreme Court reporter. Do I have that right?
Yes, yes. It was a good morning. It was an interesting morning. And it's, the thing is that when you're sitting there covering the Supreme Court, you don't get a copy of the decision.
Right.
You're just sitting there with your notebook. And then, so as Chief Justice Roberts is speaking about it, we're trying to figure out what he means. And he did start with the Commerce Clause and went right through it and declared that it was unconstitutional under the Commerce Clause. I think at that point, some news organizations jumped the gun and said, see, it's unconstitutional.
Started tweeting that out.
Yeah, and there was a big but after that, which was, we're going to go to the Taxation Clause now. And then under that, it was ruled constitutional.
Right. I find it interesting that, you know, our last guest, David Lyle, said that even the arguments before the Supreme Court, the Obama administration was arguing that this was a tax. Why was everybody so surprised? And why was that not on anybody's radar screen? I'm baffled by that one.
I mean, I think that more had to do with news coverage and people not perhaps reading the briefs, because they did. In fact, there was some political backlash about that, saying, well, you said it wasn't a tax before, but see, the Obama administration now calls it a tax now that it's in front of the court.
Right.
So they did argue that it was under the Taxation Clause, but the greater emphasis was on the Commerce Clause, certainly in the media and even in oral argument.
Yeah. One of the things I found most fascinating, Shane, about your coverage, your being in the court earlier this week for the Arizona decisions and some of those things, was your characterization of Scalia and the way he was, in my mind, you know, yelling and waving his arms around. And is that
his voice booms as it is, but he was grumpy. We'll just put it that way.
Yeah.
So was Alito.
Yeah. So were there any of those human moments today? Did you get any insight into the justices by virtue of what they said or how they read it?
Not nearly as much as on Monday. They seemed quite subdued. Chief Justice Roberts did have an interesting end to his bench statement, which I found somewhat political. You may not. He was talking about the court's role in this, and he said the court's role isn't to make policy under Marbury versus Madison, which I know you have qualms about. Yes. But he went on to say, and I thought this was a somewhat political meaning in it, he said it's the court's duty is not to save the people from the consequences of their choices. And that's a quote.
Right.
I read into that he was saying, you voted for Obama, this is what you get.
Well, of course he was. Yeah, absolutely. And don't blame me, he's saying.
Yeah, don't blame me. And the tweets are running around right now. It was Kingston from Georgia, Rain, was saying, tweeted, I've lost two friends today, America and John Roberts. And he's a conservative from Georgia.
So I
have a feeling he's going to be getting some non-fan mail, we'll call it.
And Sarah Palin is tweeting, you know, Obama said it wasn't a tax, Obama lied, freedom died. But Obama actually argued before the Supreme Court that it was a tax.
Yes, and what the justice said is, it doesn't matter what you call it. How does it act? You know,
right. You
can call it a penalty all day, but it's progressive. It, you know, so it's based on your income. You pay it to the IRS. If you make a small enough amount of money, you don't have to pay it. He goes, that sounds like a tax to me. So therefore, it's a tax.
You're paraphrasing Roberts?
Yes, that was his ruling, his reasoning, at least from the bench. I haven't had a chance. The decision is about an inch and a half thick.
Right.
But he said if it quacks like a duck.
Right. It's a duck.
It's a tax. You know?
Yeah.
So, and that's how they upheld it. But the bigger thing was and this is an interesting point that Kennedy brought up. He said, well, look what the court just did. Everyone has to get insurance now, but Medicaid is not going to expand. So you're still going to have this group of people who are uninsured, can't afford it. So there's still a problem in the system. So that's why, you know, Medicare for all is definitely the way to go.
Yeah.
This is just a step.
Well, or there's a middle ground, and I'm guessing that, and I'm getting the emails from the purists, too, who are saying, you know, Obamacare lived and progressives died because we didn't get, you know, if they had just knocked down Obamacare, then tomorrow you would have seen John Boehner push through Congress single-payer health care. And I'm like, you know, what planet are you living on? But in any case, it's conceivable that it could have provided some impetus. But the really amazing thing that is in Obamacare that nobody seems to want to talk about outside the state of Vermont and Montana is that in 2016, states can go off and do whatever they want. They can just create their own programs. And the state of Vermont has already, by virtue of the state legislature and the state House of Representatives, they have both passed a single-payer health care bill that is based and using Medicare, using federal matching funds, and thus they're very, very happy about the Medicare money. And it's been signed by the governor into law, and they are, and Bernie is out there aggressively asking, for a waiver from the 2016 so that it can be put into place in 2014, by which time the state will have their program up and running. And Montana is looking at doing the same thing. So I think we're going to see a Canadian
state-by-state system.
Yeah, you get 2, 3, 4, 5 states up with single-payer systems, and everybody realizes it costs, you know, a third less than running it through a for-profit insurance company. And it's not going to take a lot of forehead slaps. You know, whoa, look at that. I could do that.
And the citizens will demand it in the other states.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Speaking of Bernie Sanders, Bernie said he issued a press release on this today. He said it's a good day for millions of Americans who have pre-existing conditions. It's a good day for families with children under 26. It's a good day for women who can no longer be charged higher premiums than men. Good day for 30 million uninsured Americans. Good day for seniors who are going to see the donut hole closed. Good day for small businesses who can't afford escalating costs. A good day for 20 million Americans who will have full access to community health centers. And an especially a good day for Vermont because they can go to single payer.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So we'll pick up your thoughts on this right after the break. 27 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome back to your media support group for We the People of the United States of America. Here's something that, you know, if I was going to call into a conservative talk radio show right now, because I'm sure that they're all just melting down, right? I mean, just melting down. I would call in and say, may I please read to you 3 sentences from the ruling today? It's actually 4 sentences. 4 short sentences from today's healthcare ruling. Here it is. Massachusetts, Congress was told, cracked the adverse selection problem by requiring most residents to obtain insurance. The Commonwealth ensured that insurers would not be left with only the sick as customers. As a result, federal lawmakers observed, Massachusetts succeeded where other states had failed. In coupling the minimum coverage provision with guaranteed issue and community rating prescriptions, Congress followed Massachusetts' lead. Yeah. It was Romney's idea. Wouldn't it be funny if he held a press conference? He was speaking this morning. It sure looked to me like he was broadcasting from the roof of the Heritage Foundation. And they've got a whole, you know, TV camera set up there, and it's the Heritage Foundation, after all. I mean, it's one of the few places in Washington, D.C., where you can give a speech and nobody will heckle you, and if you're a Republican. And wouldn't it be funny if Romney had stepped up and said, well, I'm really glad to see that RomneyCare, reinvented as Obamacare, was confirmed by the Supreme Court, because I thought it was a pretty good thing when I passed it as governor of Massachusetts. Somehow I don't think we're gonna, yeah. Here, well, no, nah, I don't even want to play his actual clip. no thanks. Jerry in Long Island. Hey, Jerry, what's up?
Yeah, how you doing on the high court's ruling on healthcare today in favor, specifically in favor of the mandate and striking down the expansion of Medicaid? In my opinion, the ruling in favor of the mandate is just a political sellout and give away to the private health insurance industry. who, after all, they want people to be forced to buy their inferior product no matter how much they charge for it. And this is why Romney favored it in Massachusetts. And instead of that, said this mandate on individuals to buy high-priced.
No, Jerry, you're absolutely right. And this is why this is why the Heritage Foundation came up with it as an idea. So, yeah, let's force everybody to buy it from a for-profit company. Here's the thing, though. Obamacare has an escape hatch in it. Right? It's got this clause, in this backdoor clause that says after 2016, and if Congress will act after 2014, individual states can say thanks but no thanks, and they can set up their own program. And Vermont has already done so. So what we are going to see is the exact same thing Canada saw. Saskatchewan tried this out, and everybody loved it. And pretty soon, you know, within a decade, every province said, I'll have what they're having. Right? After listening to all the happy people, to extend the metaphor. Bob, in Salmonic, Illinois? Hey, Bob. What's up?
That would be Salmonic, Illinois.
Thank you. What's up?
Well, I'm an independent insurance agent, mm-hmm. and I've been doing that since 1983, mm-hmm. and I've written a lot of health insurance. And over the years, it has become more and more complicated to get people covered. And in the last 5 years, I would say the last 20 cases that I've written, even in the last couple of years, something has been denied or half of them have been rejected.
Wow.
I had an attorney rejected for psoriasis.
Psoriasis?
It was a mild case of psoriasis by Blue Cross Blue Shield.
Wow. That's amazing. And at the same time, between the time that George Bush became president and today, health insurance policy premiums have doubled. I mean, you know,
the way the system is currently, and I really don't think this was properly addressed in the Affordable Health Care Act, but what insurance companies do is they set up a trust, mm-hmm. and all the new enrollees are put in that trust. And at the end of the year, they set up a new trust, mm-hmm. and they have these huge rate increases on the old trust, and then they will say, well, if you qualify, you can enter our new trust. So what they do is they shrink the membership, because the people that don't qualify to go into the new trust stay in the old trust, and then all of a sudden the increases become 40%, 50%, 60%,
right.
until they completely price them out. It's like it's treated like car insurance. The more accidents you have, then they cancel you.
Right. Yeah.
Only they don't really cancel you. They price you out of it.
Right. And it shouldn't be. I mean, it should be that health care is a right of citizenship. It just really should be. Bob, thank you for sharing your story with us.
Absolutely. I make 20% of my income off of health insurance, and I'm in the very great minority of insurance people that would tell you this. But I would be happy to forego it to see a single-payer system.
Well, you probably would save 20% in your own personal costs if we had a single-payer system. So, Bob,
I've been in this situation.
Yeah.
I have type 2 diabetes, and I was covered. I was covered under my wife's insurance. She lost her job. It was over $650 a month for me to keep my insurance. I couldn't afford it.
Holy cow. An insurance salesman who can't. Bob, thank you for the call, and thank you for your comments. Great story. Mary in Burney, Texas. Hey, Mary.
Hi, Tom. I was so shocked this morning with the ruling that came down from the court.
I will confess, I was surprised, too.
Well, my first thought was, well, that's to get our minds off corporations. But that's already served its purpose. Mm-hmm. I mean, the money's coming in.
Yeah.
So, and they don't do anything. They don't tell lies. They don't do anything without a reason.
Yeah.
They chant their lies. And I'm puzzled. I can't figure out what they got next for us.
Well, I think for John Roberts, this was a fairly easy call. There were a couple of pieces. First of all, he doesn't have to worry about being ideologically pure. Unlike Clarence Thomas, his wife doesn't work in the right-wing industry. I mean, you know, he's my
but
UPS is going nuts here.
He's so conservative.
Yeah.
I can't imagine.
Yeah. So first of all, he doesn't have to worry about that. Secondly, he's concerned about the legacy of the Roberts Court, and you know Citizens United has tarnished it badly, and I think he's trying to fix that.
Yeah, he blew it with that.
And third, this guy was a $2 million a year corporate lawyer before he joined the court, and so he worked for big corporations and helped them make a lot of money. And guess what's going to happen as a result of this passing? Big health insurance companies, at least over the next decade or so, are going to make a pile of money. So I, you know, from his point of view, it seems to me like it's a win-win-win. I mean, Scalia and some of the others clearly have political agendas, and they're pandering to political audiences. Scalia and Alito show up at the Koch brothers' gigs. They want to still be friends with that crowd. Thomas's wife works in that industry. He doesn't want to sabotage her efforts. Mary, thank you for the call and for your comments, but that's my take on it. Mike in Montclair, New Jersey. Hey, Mike.
Yeah, hi. Listen, I'm happy about this ruling, but I'm really, really afraid it's going to set the Teabag Party on fire, and we're going to have a repeat of 2010.
I think that 2010, the Tea Party showed up in 2010, but not in greater numbers than in 2008. What happened in 2010 wasn't that the right wing showed up; it was that the left wing didn't. The Democratic voters just basically, you know, I mean, they all looked and said, "Hey, you know, we got a Democratic majority in Congress, we got President Obama in the White House, life is good. You know, I'm going to go to the baseball game," and they didn't vote. They didn't show up and vote. There was a significant drop off in votes by largely Democratic constituencies, by organized labor, by young people, by elderly people, by minorities, by women, all right across the board. All of those groups, even white male Democrats, you know, it dropped off in all categories, but in particular in the categories that were more recent participants, people who had in 2008 had gotten really excited by the Obama presidency and showed up, and then they didn't show up later, and so that's the situation there. Joe in Gordonville, Virginia. Hey, Joe, we got a minute to the break. What's up?
Oh, Tom, that's all you're going to give me?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Oh man, all right.
That's a long time, Joe, if you use it well.
Okay, in 1790, Congress mandated a law for ship owners to purchase medical insurance for the seamen.
Yeah.
In 1792, they passed a mandate for everybody to buy guns and ammo.
Right.
And 1798, Congress passed a law for all seamen to have an automatic deduction from their pay for
hospitalization. Right. Yep.
And that's three professors are the Ener, L. Haig, Harvard Law.
Yep. And during those first two mandates, there were 20 founders in Congress, in addition to George Washington as president. And during the second and third mandate, there were 17 founders in Congress, in addition to several being in the cabinets of both presidents Washington and Adams. And nobody raised a constitutional question about this. So, you know, it shouldn't be one now. You're absolutely right, Joe. Thank you for calling and sharing it with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Quoting from the United States Supreme Court, Massachusetts cracked the adverse selection problem. Congress followed Massachusetts's lead. Fair and only slightly unbalanced. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Congress, one of my favorite members of Congress, ably representing the 9th Congressional District of the great state of Illinois, U.S. Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky on the line with us, schakowsky.house.gov. Be sure to drop by her website. There's a pile of great information there. Congresswoman,
hi.
Welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much. On a great day, Tom.
It really is. I'm curious your take on what happened and also, you know, what's going forward, how this Medicare hiccup is going to be handled.
You know, I think one of your callers was kind of asking that, is this going to really energize the right-wing base now, et cetera. Mm. And here's, in my view, the difference between what happened in 2010 and now. There are right now millions of people already benefiting from Obamacare, and that means that overturning it would have been taking away now from people. That wasn't true when we first passed it. 105 million Americans no longer have a lifetime limit on their coverage. We've got 17 wow. million children with pre-existing conditions who can't be discriminated against right now. And 2.5 million young adults are on their parents' policies up to 26 years old. 5.1 million seniors who are saving on their prescription drugs, an average of $635 per senior. See, so to overturn it would have caused enormous chaos in this country. I think that John Roberts was thinking about his legacy, and I'm glad
too.
If that's what it was.
Yeah, I think that the last year or two has been a 1936 moment for this court, or at least for John Roberts. When Franklin Roosevelt tried to pack the court in 36, and he was not successful, but there was so much public pressure for him to do something because the court kept knocking down the New Deal things, that in 37, the court in that judicial session, the court started just consistently ruling in his favor, and there'd been no change in the composition of the court. They just got it. The public opinion was not with them anymore, and I think that maybe John Roberts is noticing the same thing.
Well, also, you know, for him to overturn something that was passed by the Congress, signed by the president, and affects so many millions of Americans, this
yeah.
really is just a landmark decision that I think is going to go up there with Social Security and Medicare as one of the great achievements of our time, certainly of this century. And for him to overturn it, and it's not just that a bunch of people are already getting help, which is important, but hospital systems, hospitals themselves are beginning to change. They got money to do electronic records and to do coordinated care. We've got states that have been working on setting up exchanges for people to get enrolled in insurance. And so I just think that he absolutely did the right thing for himself, for his legacy, and certainly for the country. I was just thrilled.
That is great. Now, there's also, coming to the floor of the House any minute now, there's this bizarre conspiracy theory that two black guys in the White House, and I've seen it laid out like this in emails that are circulating in the right.
Really?
Two black guys in the White House were trying to figure out how to get guns away from white people. And they decided to send a bunch of guns to brown people down in Mexico who would come up here and shoot up the white people who would get so frightened they'd say, do away with the Second Amendment, and thus the black guys in the White House would win. And this conspiracy theory has been embraced by the NRA. It's been embraced by Darrell Issa. It's been embraced by other Republican members of Congress. And I understand that the Congressional Black Caucus, when Darrell Issa holds his contempt hearing against Holder, is actually going to walk out in protest of it. Are you going to be there? What's going on? What's happening with Congress?
Yes, I'm actually in the cloakroom right off the House floor right now. There is first going to be a vote in order to refer this to another committee. John Dingell, Democrat, is going to do a motion. We're all going to be there the Democrats are to support his motion. To refer to committee. That will likely fail. Then the Republicans will move to the contempt of Congress motion, and at which point Nancy Pelosi will lead a walk off the floor of the House because it is such
wow.
a blatant abuse of power. And I'm really proud to join that effort to just say, no, we're not even going to participate in this witch hunt. And that's all it is.
Yeah.
It's
Well,
Fortune magazine day before yesterday published this piece about how not only was it not the federal, and I actually thought it was for some time there. You know, I was believing the propaganda too that they were selling guns into Mexico so that they could track the serial numbers. They weren't doing that. They were trying to bust gun dealers in and these straw man buyers in Arizona. And the problem that they federal prosecutors kept coming up against is that they, you know, the laws in Arizona are so lax that they couldn't arrest or prosecute these people. They couldn't get judges to give them warrants.
It is absolutely stunning. There are 800 and some gun dealers in Phoenix. They do not require any waiting period. You don't have to have a license. You can buy as many guns as you want. They advertise that on billboards. Come and buy, you know, bulk purchases of, yep, of guns. And the NRA is going to score this, which means that people who are frightened to death of the NRA not endorsing them and saying that, you know, people shouldn't vote for them, will, and there will probably be some Democrats, will vote with the NRA. But, you know, the president of Mexico, Calderon, came to the Congress in a joint session in 2010 and said that when the United States let the assault weapons ban lapse, that guns began pouring across the border. I mean, it seriously is a problem, the proliferation of these assault weapons, one of which was used to kill a border agent and another to shoot Gabby Giffords.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the NRA is taking this preemptive strike, so God forbid anybody dares to say that maybe we ought to do something about the guns.
Yeah, well said. Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky, thank you so much for being with
always
us today.
Always my pleasure, Tom. Keep up the good work.
Thank you. And you too, please. And always an honor to have you on our program. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, here's my biggest picture possible take on today's Supreme Court ruling. It never should have happened. Everything about today, from Fox and CNN screwing up the ruling early on, to the hours of punditry that followed, to the competing speeches from Mitt Romney and President Obama, none of it should have happened. None of it should have happened because our democracy settled this issue more than 2 years ago when, after a year of debate, our elected members of Congress passed Obamacare with the majority in both the House and the Senate, and that law was signed by our elected president of the United States. That's how our democracy works. We elect people to write and pass our laws, and then we keep electing them, or we elect someone else, if we don't like the way that they're doing the job, to do that job for them. But what happened today was not an exercise in democracy. It was an exercise in monarchy. Despite our democracy settling this issue, here we all were today waiting to hear from the modern-day oracles at Delphi. Our news media, our elected politicians, and the tens of millions of Americans who finally had some reprieve thanks to Obamacare were forced to wait at the steps of the Supreme Court building where 9 unelected judges, like kings and queens, would ultimately give their final say to the trivial concerns of we the people. What happened today reveals a deep flaw in our system of government, a flaw that was created more than 200 years ago. In the early days of our nation, the Supreme Court was a very, very boring place. It was, as the Constitution says, simply the final arbiter in legal disputes, which at the time tended to be things like, and I'm not making this up, a legal battle between two farmers who were arguing over whose dog ate whose chickens. The idea of the unelected Supreme Court having the power to strike down an entire law passed by an elected Congress and signed by an elected president, unthinkable. The idea that our early senators and representatives would have to wait outside the doors of the Supreme Court, like Michelle Bachmann and Orrin Hatch did today, waiting for the justices' ruling on laws that they had passed out of Congress, is unheard of. After all, nowhere in the Constitution does it say that the Supreme Court has the power to strike down or maintain laws. In fact, Article 3, Section 2 says just the opposite. It says the court has to operate under regulations established by Congress. So how did the court get all this power? How did they become the kings and queens of America? It happened in 1803. It was the case of Marbury versus Madison, and it changed everything. That was when the High Court assumed the power to strike down laws. They called this doctrine judicial review. The judges could review laws. It is not in the Constitution. Thomas Jefferson was the president at the time, and he knew the consequences of this power grab by the Supreme Court. He knew that it effectively turned our democracy into a monarchy that stripped power from we the people and handed it off to nine kings in black robes. As Jefferson wrote to John Adams' wife, Abigail Adams, in 1804, quote, "The opinion which gives to the judges the right to decide what laws are constitutional and what not, not only for themselves in their own sphere of action, but for the legislature and executive also in their spheres, would make the judiciary a despotic branch." This is a letter he wrote to John Adams' wife. He and John Adams were not at that point in time on such great terms. I think it's part of the process of his trying to reach out. But he, you know, what they have to talk about, well, you know, do we really want the Supreme Court to run the country? And as Jefferson wrote to Virginia Supreme Court Justice and Patrick Henry's father-in-law, Spencer Roane, back in 1819, "If the judiciary is the last resort in relation to the other departments of the government, then indeed is our Constitution a complete felo de se, a suicide pact. The Constitution on this hypothesis is a mere thing of wax in the hands of the judiciary." Jefferson knew the job of interpreting the Constitution should be left up to we the people, by electing representatives every 2 years who write and pass laws based on their interpretation of the Constitution. And if we, the people, don't like how our elected representatives are interpreting the Constitution, guess what happens? We vote them out of office. As Jefferson wrote in 1823, still bitter about the Supreme Court's decision 20 years earlier, quote, "The case of Marbury and Madison is continually cited by bench and bar as if it were settled law. The Chief Justice says there must be an ultimate arbiter somewhere. True, there must. But the ultimate arbiter is the people themselves. Today's display on the steps of the Supreme Court was not the America envisioned by our founders. And it was particularly not the America envisioned by the author of our Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson. In writing the Declaration of Independence, Jefferson struck the first blow against monarchy, only to see it creep back into America in the form of the Supreme Court during his own first term as president. Can you imagine how crazy that made him? And it's still with us today. Yeah, the court probably did the right thing in upholding Obamacare, but as long as they have this power that's called judicial review, and then the doctrine that followed it in 1825, judicial supremacy, as long as they have that power, the power to strike down laws passed by the representatives of we the people, then it's just a matter of time before they abuse that power, just like they abused it in 2010 when the Roberts Court wiped out a century of campaign finance laws with Citizens United. Healthcare for all is vital for our nation. Restoring power in the hands of we the people and not keeping it concentrated in the hands of nine unelected kings and queens, that's our biggest challenge. So how do we do this? Let me share with you my theory on the arc of this. Back in the 1990s, I think it was 1997, 98, Louise and I moved to Vermont and bought this house in Montpelier that had been built in 1860. And we had sold an ad agency in Atlanta and kind of retired. It was before we'd started the radio show. I was going to write some books. And in the carriage house, the attic of the garage of this old house in downtown Montpelier, we found all kinds of boxes of just totally weather-damaged books, including a complete set of the collected works of Thomas Jefferson. It's only been published once. In 1809, the anniversary of his leaving the White House, 100-year anniversary. I'm sorry, 1909. And the collected works of Thomas Jefferson, published by the Thomas Jefferson Society, it had his diaries, his personal diaries, all of his letters, his correspondence with his family, all kinds of cool stuff. And I was going to write a book called What Would Jefferson... I ultimately did write a book called What Would Jefferson Do? But I started out to write this book, and halfway through, and you know, having spent 2 years reading Jefferson's writings, just up to my eyeballs in Thomas Jefferson. And halfway through the book, I discovered this Santa Clara County case in 1886. And so that book became Unequal Protection, the book about Citizens United. And then later I wrote a book called What Would Jefferson Do? But back then when I wrote Unequal Protection, when I started talking about corporate personhood, nobody knew what I was talking about. I would go to law schools and give talks about, you know, Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad and corporate personhood. People were like, yes. Don't have any idea what you're talking about. And the average person had no clue what I was talking about. We published the book. It made a minor splash among the circles of people who are into the law. But it wasn't until Citizens United that all of a sudden that book became a bestseller. It got into the public consciousness. Corporate personhood, really? So now everybody knows what it's all about. I think that judicial review is going to do the same thing. And it's going to happen because you and I talk about it. Tell enough people. You know, the Constitution does not give the Supreme Court the power to strike down laws. Pass it along.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So where do we go from here and how do we do this? I'll share my thoughts with you and we're going to pick up yours, too, right after this break. Minutes past the hour. Welcome back to the place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, not a chance, no way. Give me a break. Mary in Charlotte, North Carolina. Hey, Mary, what's on your mind today?
Hi. I just want to say I'm really, really ecstatic about the healthcare ruling passing. However, I'm very concerned because I work in healthcare. I'm a physician assistant. And what worries me is that big pharma, profit-making hospital systems and insurance companies are going to take advantage of this by raising prices even more than what we have now. So my question is, how are we going to fix that part of healthcare that's really, really hurting us?
Right. With regard to the big pharma, one of the things that needs to be done is to allow Medicare to negotiate for prescription drug prices. Now, this bill doesn't do that. This bill is not about fixing Medicare. And that's the big problem with Big Pharma, frankly. And it's a $300 billion subsidy to Big Pharma. And, you know, but with regard to the big insurance companies ripping us off, a law that went into effect just a few months ago, or a piece of Obamacare that went into effect a few months ago, says that big insurance companies have to spend between 80 and 85% of all the money they take in on actual direct services, on actual care. And so if you're noticing that the health insurance companies are getting a little more liberal in saying yes to tests that you ask for or things like that, it's because if they don't spend 80 to 85%, depending on the size of the company, on actual services, at the end of the year, they have to cut a rebate check to the people who paid the premiums. And they're loath
the
to do that.
The problem with that, though, Tom, is when you look at big profit-making hospital systems who have gobbled up a lot of physician practices, you know, there's really no price controls on hospitals. You go into a hospital for a procedure, they charge $25 for a Band-Aid. So the problem lies not only in insurance companies and what they're going to be mandated to do, but they're going to have to reimburse for the services that the hospitals are charging. So that needs to be fixed as well.
There are some provisions in Obamacare that do limit increases in medical care costs. And that $25 Band-Aid in the hospital is, you're not paying for the Band-Aid, you're paying for the hospital. You're paying for the venue in which it's just like when you go to the movie and you buy what otherwise would be a 25-cent bag of popcorn, you pay $4 for it. what you're really paying for is the ability to have that popcorn in the movie. And
right, but you're also paying for the big chief executives to bring home their huge executive salaries.
Of course, and something needs to be done about that. But let's not make the perfect the enemy of the good. This is a really important first step. It has established for the first time, literally for the first time in the history of America, that we're all in this together, which is the fundamental mentality out of which comes everything else. You know, single payer programs, the idea that Ted Kennedy fought for his whole entire life, that we should enshrine in law and maybe in the Constitution that healthcare is a right, not a privilege.
Not a privilege.
I see this as a positive step, and I'm not among the naysayers who go, oh, I wish they'd knocked it down so then we could have Medicare for all. I suggest on this program a couple days ago, if they do knock it down, then we all need to fight like crazy for Medicare for all. But there's no way that with the Republicans having enough votes in the Senate to have a filibuster and having control of the House of Representatives, that that's going to happen this year or probably not, you know, in the next couple of years. It's going to take a big political movement for that to happen. And this law, this Obamacare law, actually provides for states to have their own single-payer systems, just like Canada, starting in 2016. Yeah. So I see this coming down the road. Mary, I got to move along, but thank you for the call and for your concern and for being a physician's assistant. That's a fine thing. Paul in Detroit, Michigan. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom. I wanted to respond to Sarah Palin. I think I have a good nickname for her. Governor Quitter on Twitter.
That's what she was on Twitter this morning. She said, Obama said it wasn't a tax. Obama lied, democracy died. First of all, they did argue before the Supreme Court that it was a tax, and the president has never lied about this. And what is, everybody getting health care, what does that have to do with democracy dying?
Yeah,
especially
I
if the majority of us want that.
Yeah. What freedom is she trying to protect? The freedom to be ripped off and cheated by an insurance company?
She's trying to protect the freedom of a multimillionaire like herself from paying more in taxes. I mean, it's really very simple. If she wants to take a principled stand and not buy health insurance, she's going to have to pay 2.5% of her income as that tax penalty, you know, that John Roberts upheld. And, you know, if you're making $1 million a year, 2.5% is $25,000. That's a lot to pay for health insurance. So it's not $250,000. Yeah, it's $25,000. So, I think that that's really what's going on. This is just pure ideology. Paul, thanks for the call. Joe in Toledo. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Congresswoman who was on earlier.
Jan Schakowsky.
Yes. Would you say to Democrats, you know, you sold us out on the health care without giving us the public option? They always respond with, yes, but look what a great price we list those, you know, age 26 and no cap on benefits and so forth. And it hasn't worked for 2 years. I think they need to work on that, find something else. But my main point.
You know who John Quincy Adams was?
Yes.
You know, he was president of the United States. And then you know why he went back to the House of Representatives after he was president?
Why?
So he could work to end slavery and legal apartheid in the United States. That was in the 1830s. Now, when did we ultimately end legal apartheid in the United States? We still haven't, really, but in the 1960s. Just because this bill is not perfect does not mean it's a sellout.
Okay. All right. Well, granting you that, just wanted to make the point that I think Obama just lost Ohio.
Well, I hope not. I personally think that it all is going to depend on the sales job. You know, the right-wingers are going to be in there like crazy, putting out the talking points that Mitt Romney put out today, which are by and large lies. And we'll see. We know, will big money and lies beat the truth? Time will tell.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
In fact, let's go through some of Romney's lies when we come back, and we'll pick up your calls as well. Welcome back. Very interesting analysis. This question being raised over at Fire Dog Lake. People are now starting to dig through the documents. right? And they're noticing things. And one of the things that they're noticing is that Antonin Scalia, in his commentaries in this Affordable Health Care Act, is referring to Ruth Bader Ginsburg's comments. Now, she joined the majority opinion. Okay, she was one of the five who voted to uphold the Affordable Care Act. In his reference to her, well, I'll just read you the sentence. Catch this. Ultimately, the dissent is driven to saying that there is really no difference between action and inaction, anti-Ep 26, blah, blah, blah. He is referring, Antonin Scalia is referring, in fact, he does it eight times, referring to Ginsburg's commentary as a dissent. Now, it wasn't a dissent. It was a concurring opinion of the majority. So is it possible that, say, on Monday of this week, what Ginsburg had written was a dissent, and that Roberts changes his vote? And if so, why? Now, there's another possibility, and that is that Ginsburg was concurring in some things and dissenting on others, and so you could argue that, you know, he's referring to the part where she's saying no, but the David Dayan blogging over at Fire Dog Lake has really, really dug through this, and he points out how back, this was David Bernstein back in May of this year, was writing about how back in May there were rumors floating around relevant legal circles that a key vote was taking place and that Roberts was feeling tremendous pressure from unidentified circles to uphold the mandate. So why did Roberts vote for this? Was it that he was being pressured? That he was offered a job? That his wife was offered a job like Clarence Thomas? That he thought it was the right thing to do? I know the theory that you'll hear on right-wing talk radio. The president called him up and threatened him, right? Yeah. I mean, Lyndon Johnson probably would have done that. he had the chairman of the Fed in his office one day, in the Oval Office one day, and grabbed him by the shirt collar and slammed him up against the wall, lifted him up on his tippy toes, and shouted at him, throwing spittle all over his face, that he could not raise interest rates going into an election. I think the guy's name was Miller. It's been quite a few years since I read that story, but the ironic twist or end to it was that Johnson did this a lot. I mean, you know, he would invite reporters into the bathroom while he's sitting on the throne. You know, it's as a way of like basically intimidating people. Just, you know, hey, I'm a big dog here. But the head of the Fed went back and raised interest rates anyway. So the question: if Roberts changed his vote at the last minute, why? This was, you know, question our first guest, the David Lyle, the senior counsel at Media Matters, was saying, you know, nobody's really sure why Roberts voted the way he did, because it certainly isn't anything anybody saw coming based on the oral arguments and everything else. You know, he seemed to have dismissed the tax argument. And certainly his four right-wing buddies are just hopping mad. So I may have just provided you, or actually David Dayan over at Fire Dog Lake may have just provided you, let's give credit where credit is due, with an advance glimpse into next week's Fox conspiracy theory, right? Are they going to hold, is Congress now going to vote to hold the president in contempt because he threatened Chief Justice Roberts? Or maybe it was Joe Biden. Maybe he knocked on his door in the middle of the night. Hey, buddy, how you doing? Somehow I doubt it. But anyway, Natalie in Auburn, Alabama. Hey, Natalie, what's up?
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What's on your mind?
Just to start out as an aside, I went to a school when I was raised in a town called Marbury, Alabama.
Oh, really?
And I never knew that it was the namesake of such a landmark case.
Amazing, yeah.
But anyway, as a, I I don't know if it's right or not, and I don't want anybody to say that this is verbatim, but in the reading I heard at the end of what John Roberts said, it seemed like he almost said, like, the job of the court is to not find policy unconstitutional, but to, I mean, to try to find if it's constitutional.
Well, what he's, no, actually what he said, and I had his quote here someplace, but I can paraphrase it pretty well.
Okay.
Is what he said was, it's not the job of this court to correct mistakes made by the voters.
Yes.
And, you know, those are my words, not his, but that's very close. And what he was saying was, you know, the vote, hey, you guys voted for the Democrats. You voted for Obama. You got Obamacare. Tough luck. If you don't like it, elect a legislature, elect a bunch of right-wing Tea Partiers, and they'll change it. And sure enough, you know, as soon as the decision came down, Mitt Romney comes out. I have an email from Mitt saying, dear Tom, my friend, today...
Dear Tom, your friend.
I'm not making this up. It's a letter I got from Mitt Romney, me and probably, you know, 5 million of his closest friends. Today, the Supreme Court upheld Obamacare, but regardless of what the court said about the constitutionality of the law, Obamacare is bad medicine, bad policy, and when I'm president, the bad news of Obamacare will be over. On day one, I will work to repeal Obamacare to stop our government's takeover of our health care and intrusion in our lives. Right. Right.
It's the same thing ad hominem over and over again.
Yeah, but the point is that what Roberts said at the very end of his ruling was that he was arguing in favor of what's called judicial restraint, which is saying, you know, it's really not our job to make bad laws into good laws. It's our job to determine whether or not a law is constitutional, at least in the post-Marbury world. And
I'm glad you clarified that.
Yeah. So thank you very much, Natalie, for the call. Great to hear from you. Michael in Dublin, Virginia. Hey, Michael, what's on your mind today?
Yes, Tom.
Yes. Yes,
yeah?
Yes.
Okay, hey, Tom, this is what's on my mind. You raised some good points as to Judge Scalia the other day in his pantry with the his golf buddies, his corporate buddies, and how this is against our against our rules of conduct. We also raised the point today that the black robes have the power to overturn what we the people vote for.
Yeah.
This is something, a talking point that ought to be taken to every populace that we can reach.
I agree.
And this is the back door that you've been speaking out, possibly, the back door to change, to improve upon the Supreme Court, that power, that authority that they have. So this is something we ought to raise issues of, I believe.
Well, and Congress can actually do this. Under Article 3, Section 2 of the United States Constitution, it says that the Supreme Court shall operate within regulations defined by Congress. And Congress could simply pass a law. Now, the Supreme Court might try to strike it down, which create a constitutional crisis. And in the event of a constitutional crisis, guess who wins? Congress. They're the first among equals. But Congress could pass a law that says that the Supreme Court does not have the power to strike down laws, that that's a power that the Congress is reserving to itself. It would defy 200 years of judicial, you know, precedent, but it would not defy the original intent of the founders. And that's why I've been talking about it. Michael, thank you for the call. Thanks for pointing that out. And, oh, by the way, one of the people commenting over a Fire Dog Lake about, you know, everybody's asking, why did Robert switch his vote at the light? Why did he write? Maybe the justices vote on Diebold machines. I'm just saying, right? Jim in Los Angeles. Hey, Jim, what's up? Hey, Jim.
Hello?
Yeah, you're on the air.
Yeah, I wanted to bring up a point that I've been listening to all the newscasts this morning. I think that the decision was not that much a Democratic victory. It was the Republicans cutting their losses. Any other decision would have been a disaster, and I think that they realized that in the long term, that so much chaos would have developed if they had.
Because if the court had actually struck down Obamacare in its whole, and suddenly 6 million kids no longer have health insurance who had it yesterday, suddenly 5 million people under 26 who have health insurance don't have it, suddenly millions and millions of people, you know, 105 million people with pre-existing conditions are hanging out hanging off the ledge. If that had happened, then the focus would have gone to the House of Representatives, Eric Cantor and John Boehner, and we'd be saying, okay, guys, what are you going to replace it with? And they'd be going, and so, yeah, it could have been a really bad outcome for the Republicans. You're absolutely right.
But I think Boehner could not figure that out.
Yeah. Well,
and I think he knew it. I think the oligarchy is taken over here. They don't take the House of Representatives seriously anyway.
Well, they're going to hold it. The House is now going to vote on July 9th, I guess it was. I think it is. Right after the 4th of July, they're going to vote to repeal Obamacare. And they will do it, of course. You know, they've got a Republican majority. So, you know, it won't go anywhere. The Senate won't even consider it. But they're going to repeal Obamacare. Right. Just like they repealed Medicare. You know, they voted to turn Medicare into a voucher program. So, hey, Grandma, here's a $7,000 voucher. Please call these 22 health insurance companies and negotiate with them. Good luck. Right. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Could it be that the Supreme Court is voting on D-Bowl machines? Or as an alternative, what is Mitt Romney's alternative plan going to be? Welcome back, Exposing the Con and Conservative. Tom Hartman here with you. Ron Pollack is with us. He is the founding executive director of Families USA, familiesusa.org. Ron, welcome back to the program.
Well, delighted to be with you, Tom.
Thank you. You have been involved for much of your life in healthcare policy and do a really, really great job. You really know what's going on. What in your mind is the biggest, what do our listeners and viewers need to know about what happened today?
Well, the bottom line is the Affordable Care Act is moving forward. This was a big victory, and the way I think about it, you know, what this really will achieve is to provide peace of mind to families so that the health care and coverage that they need will be there for them when they need it. The Affordable Care Act provides a huge number of things for people that protect them from insurance company bad practices like denying coverage due to pre-existing conditions for, you know, kids who might have asthma or diabetes, or charging discriminatory premiums based on health status, or charging women a discriminatory higher premium, placing arbitrary caps on how much they pay out in a year or in a lifetime, so someone with a major illness or accident is denied coverage at a point they most need it. You know, the Affordable Care Act provides subsidies for middle-class families so they can afford health coverage. It'll add coverage for tens of millions of people across the country. It'll even help senior citizens by providing them with preventive care services for free under Medicare, and it closes the big gap in coverage they have for prescription drugs. So, you know, the Affordable Care Act now moves forward in all these different ways, and those who were trying to attack it were hoping that they could take down all of these new protections and benefits. And the bottom line is they lost, and America's families won. And we're going to see these benefits and these protections in effect in states across the country.
Now, the Medicare decision, we didn't win.
You mean the Medicaid?
Medicaid. Thank you for correcting me. Medicaid is the state federal partnership programs administered by the states for basically below poverty level or below a percentage of poverty level people in those states. And in that case, there was a carrot and a stick. The carrot was, we're going to give you a whole bunch of extra money for Medicaid for you to administer programs. In fact, Vermont wants to use that money to turn to create a single payer system for their state. The stick was, if you don't take this money, you lose all your Medicaid money. The Supreme Court Chief Justice Roberts, in his opinion, said, you know, you can't, that's too big a stick.
That's right.
And
that's,
so what do we do?
Well, the carrot is huge. And I think that that carrot is so substantial that states, I believe, will avail themselves of it. Remember,
but Scott Walker's already said he's not going to take it. And I mean, you know, I think that the thinking here of these Republican governors is that they can turn it down. I mean, they've had no reluctance to punish people who are on food stamps. I mean, Rick Scott was trying to drug test them all, or actually did. It's like poor people are the easily kicked to the curb in our society.
Yeah, you know, any governor who turns this down is committing fiscal malpractice. You know that one of the parallel programs is the so-called Children's Health Insurance Program. It's an optional program. It's not a mandatory program. And the amount paid by the federal government to cover the cost of that program is quite a bit lower than the Affordable Care Act provides with respect to the coverage in that legislation. And so we already have precedents of literally every single state in the country picking up the Children's Health Insurance Program when they didn't have to do so. Now, it means that a governor who's thinking of turning it down, the governor, in fact, is then saying, well, you know, our state will pick up costs like uncompensated health care for the uninsured, like when they come to public hospitals, and, you know, the states will pick that up. Why not take 100% and ultimately 90% from the federal government? There's never been such a generous carrot offered to the states.
Yeah, that's right. Reagan's mandate required the states to see people if they show up at emergency rooms and pay for it. So this would cover the backside of that.
So now people will get care, you know, in a timely basis. They'll get preventive care and primary care. They won't just show up in emergency rooms when problem is too late. You know, we issued a report last week that was based on the methodology developed by the Institute of Medicine, the prestigious scientific body on healthcare, that showed that in 2010, more than 26,000 people died due to a lack of health insurance. Well, I mean, this is a big deal, and so I think that some of the governors are acting still based on politics. You know, this litigation was politics. They wanted to wipe out the entire Affordable Care Act despite all the help it provides. Now they've lost that. The law of the land. 5-4 decision, and, you know, that's despite the fact that the majority of the appointees are Republican.
Now, the right-wingers are buzzing that John Roberts changed his vote because the president threatened him or something. Or he had to have been offered something. Middle of the road folks are saying, well, you know, maybe he's concerned about his legacy, or he just, you know, accepted the argument. I'm wondering if they're voting on Diebold machines. I'm curious what your theory is.
Well, I was in the court all 3 days during oral argument. I've argued cases in the Supreme Court. I used to be a law school dean. Mm-hmm. I think almost, almost all legal scholars, by a huge margin, before this litigation came to the Supreme Court, said it really didn't have merit. And even justice clerks, by a huge margin, said they didn't think this case had merit. And the only reason this was close is because, you know, this was a highly contentious political issue. I think Justice Roberts tried to rule on the merits here.
Yeah. Well, that's what he's supposed to do. So that would be the good thing, I suppose. Ron Pollack, the founding executive director of Families USA, familiesusa.org. Thank you, Ron.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me.
Great talking with you. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Congressman Ted Deutsch on the line with us, representing the 19th District of Florida and brilliantly doing so. His website, Ted Deutsch, D-E-U-T-C-H, .house.gov. And Congressman, welcome back to the program.
Thanks. Great to be with you.
Thank you for joining us. So I guess two things here have happened today of some consequence. The first being the Supreme Court ruling in Obamacare, and the second being this whole kerfuffle, this weird conspiracy theory that Daryl Issa has, that President Obama is trying to get people to give up their Second Amendment rights by scaring them by having a bunch of people come over from Mexico and shoot the place up. So if that's okay with you, we'll take those in that order.
That's as well put as I've heard. Actually, Tom, I don't. There are two things that happened. Two things that happened today in Washington. That is true. One of them, I would suggest, is consequential. One of them is absurd political theater.
Yes.
So,
but worthy of commentary.
so let's actually talk about the one that's consequential, which is. Yeah. This historic decision by the Supreme Court,
yes, sir,
that upholds the Affordable Care Act, but more than that, it ensures that the more than a million Americans who are going to see over $1 billion in rebates from insurance companies who spent more money on overhead and profit than they did on care, those will continue on. That the 6 million young Americans will be able to continue to have health care on their parents' policies. 5 million seniors will continue to see the donut hole shrink and prescription drug prices come down. And most importantly, and I think not to be lost in all this political analysis, tens of millions of Americans who don't currently have health care will now finally have access to it. That's what makes this historic. That's what I know that everyone is focusing on, and we're going to look back on this day and write about it and think about it a lot over the years.
Yeah. The thing that excites me the most about Obamacare, or Romneycare, if you want to call it that, I mean,
exactly.
Which I think is...
Or Roberts Care.
Yeah, or Heritage Foundation Care. But it is not so much that... actually, this isn't... Obamacare has some significant differences from the Heritage Foundation's original proposal and from what Mitt Romney put together in Massachusetts. And I think one of the most important ones is the one that Vermont is walking into, Montana's talking about doing, but Vermont's already passed the legislation. And that is that in 2016, and if we can get a waiver in 2014, individual states will be free to do what Saskatchewan did up in Canada and experiment with their own single-payer health care systems using Medicaid dollars to do it. And, you know, Vermont is just ready to go. I see this as the launching pad for a vastly improved healthcare system. I'm curious your take on that.
Yeah, again, there's been so much talk about whether this is constitutional or not, whether the mandate will stand up or not, that we've missed the opportunity to talk about some of the bigger long-term items in this bill, which deserve serious attention, and that is, and you've touched on it, the ability for states and healthcare providers to experiment, to innovate, and to come up with new ways to deliver healthcare in an affordable way. You're right; they're moving forward in those states. My state, however, is going in a different direction with a governor who still refuses to believe that the Affordable Care Act is law. But it does provide that.
I think
that
he still believes, he refuses to believe the earth is round. I mean, you have my sympathy for it.
Well, thanks. I'm not sure that, probably someone should ask him that at a press conference.
Yeah.
But you're exactly right. And as this goes forward, the opportunities that will play out to really change the way healthcare is delivered, to make it more responsive to individuals, to make it more affordable, to address so many of the issues that have plagued us for so long, that's what's really exciting about this, and finally we're going to be able to focus on that.
Now, the Medicaid option got blown up. We were talking with Ron Pollack about this a little bit ago with Families USA, and nobody seems sure about what can be done. Basically, the Supreme Court took away the big stick of you will lose all your Medicaid funding if you don't take more Medicaid funding, if you don't expand the program. And you've got some governors like Scott Walker, who's on the record as saying he's not going to take the money. It wouldn't surprise me if Rick Scott does the same thing. And so lacking that stick, could we not end up in a situation like we had with education, you know, 40 years ago, where if you had the misfortune of being born in a really poor state, you're doomed to bad schools. And if you're born in a really wealthy state, you're going to have great schools. And, you know, only this would be the healthcare analog of that, I suppose, particularly if you're poor. And if that's the case, is there anything Congress can do about it given this decision?
Well, first of all, the way that as you project forward, it may not, Tom, be a question of poor states versus rich states. It could be a question of states with governors who refuse to acknowledge the existence of and role of the federal government, like Wisconsin and Florida, and states where they do. I point out that the Medicaid piece had sticks, but it also had really big carrots, and I think it's important to point out that there are Scott Walker could decide that he's not going to accept the federal dollars, and Governor Scott in my state could decide that.
But, just like he did with transportation money.
Yeah, but for the first 3 years of the program, it's a 100% amount from the federal government.
Right.
So this is a very big carrot, and ultimately there's going to have to be, especially in light of the way the court ruled on this, there's going to have to be a lot of pressure brought to bear at the state level, at the grassroots level, to ensure that they don't pass up the opportunity to move forward in this way with the help of the federal government, but in a way that's ultimately going to help, in the case of Florida, millions of Floridians.
Maybe you guys could attach to next year's highway bill something that says that any state that doesn't take the Medicaid dollars, all along their highways there will be billboards that say, your governor didn't take the Medicare money, and so all you get is a lousy T-shirt.
Right, and in Florida, by the way, there would be more people to see that since they won't be on the high-speed rail since the governor turned back that money.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely. But seriously, is there any kind of buzz in Congress about, you know, legislative fixes to this, or do you think that the carrot is going to be big enough?
Well,
and public pressure is going to be enough.
I think the carrot is very significant. But the president talked about it today, and we've been talking a lot about the same thing, which is, you know, this is a really historic day. This is an incredibly positive step forward for the country. But now we're going to have to take a deep breath and go back. And if there are things that need to be changed, then we need to get to the work of doing it. Unfortunately, my friends on the other side of the aisle believe, as we saw this afternoon and as I'm about to head off to vote again on another one of these, instead they believe in political theater. Today it's contempt charges against the Attorney General.
Right.
In a couple of weeks, it's going to be yet another vote to repeal the health care law, the Affordable Care Act, without ever providing any insight into how it is that they would stop the abuses of the insurance company that everyone in America believes ought to be curbed.
Yeah, it really is rather breathtaking. And I got a letter today, an email from my friend Mitt Romney. Dear
you
friend
did.
Tom. Yeah, he says, we cannot afford Barack Obama's on-the-job learning and big government proposals and irresponsible spending. This doesn't seem irresponsible to me.
Well, I wonder what emails then-Governor Romney sent out to tout his health care overhaul when he was the governor of Massachusetts.
Oh, yeah. Somehow he's not mentioning that in this email.
Be curious to find out.
Yeah, there you go. Congressman Ted Deutsch of Florida's 19th District. TedDeutsch.house.gov, the website. Sir, thank you very much for being with us today.
It's always a pleasure. Thanks, Tom.
Great talking with you. And good luck with the constitutional amendment, too, to roll back Citizens United. We'll be right back, 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So where do we go from here? And what I want to deconstruct some of the things that Mitt Romney had to say today as well. And we'll pick up your calls, too. Welcome back to the place where despair is not an option, the Tom Hartman Program. And Brian in Asheville, North Carolina. Hey, Brian, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I was wondering if you think the right's argument on Obamacare being too much of a burden on small businesses is overblown.
Sure. Okay, thank you very much. Yeah, it's radically overblown. First of all, Obamacare does not mandate that small businesses have to carry health insurance. It mandates that individuals have to carry health insurance. So, you know, I run a small business. We do provide health care to our full-time employees. If we didn't, Obamacare wouldn't force me to. Secondly, there is a provision in Obamacare, and I don't know all the details of this. Our the way that we do the radio and TV show here, most of what we run is we run our payroll through WYD Media, which is my agent and business manager Ron Hartenbaum's company, and so he's the one who's writing the paychecks and doing the health insurance for our employees. So I frankly don't know the details of it. I get the luxury of being on the air rather than being a businessman these days, which is sweet. But I do know that for certain kinds of small businesses, and I don't know if ours qualifies for it or not, I'm guessing probably not, but for certain kinds of small businesses and entrepreneurial ventures, there's also, if you want to provide health insurance to your employees, there's also a small subsidy. And so actually Obamacare is good for small businesses. And if everybody's insured, or even if you choose not to be insured and you have virtually no income and you're going to have to pay 2.5% of nothing, right, because you're not insured, but everybody is covered, everybody has access to health care, people are going to be more likely to start small businesses. I can tell you, as a guy who started 7 small businesses in my life, a couple of which became fairly large businesses, that when you step out and do that, particularly if you have kids, as Louise and I did, it can be a scary thing. And not having health insurance is part of that. So I think it's frankly a good thing. I think it's a very good thing. Jeff in San Francisco. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Not much, Tom. I'm pretty happy. Like you're saying, it's not perfect, but it's improvement. And my own paycheck shows that. I'm looking over because as a teacher, we start every year. June 30th is our fiscal year. Mm-hmm. And in 2000, I had saved about $342 off my premiums and health insurance since the last year.
That's great. So, that's because your health insurance company used to take that money and give it to the CEOs or spend it on the Christmas party, and now they've got to actually pay for health care with it. So
I could see it's much improvement. One other thing, if I could throw in, do you think the Disclosure Act might be another small little victory for us we should shoot for against Citizens United?
Yeah, absolutely, except that the Republicans have filibustered it in the Senate. We need to get a filibuster-proof Democratic majority in the Senate, and we need to have the Democrats take back the House of Representatives, or that Disclose Act, which would basically force Karl Rove to say where his money's coming from. All this dark money, and it's going to be probably over $1 billion this year in secret money, and much of it is coming from outside the United States and in support of Republican candidates, and this is not good. This is just not good for democracy. Jeff, thanks for the call. Well said. Richard in Bloomfield Hills, Michigan. Hey, Richard, what's up? You have a theory about why John Roberts ruled this way?
Yes, hi, Tom.
Hey.
I think that, in fact, he's very much concerned about his legacy in light of Citizens United.
That's my theory.
And some of these biased cases that have come up in the Supreme Court.
Yeah,
and
I...
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No.
If you look at his opinion online, you'll see that he actually is somewhat conservative to the degree that he brings up McCulloch versus Maryland from the 1800s as the basis for congressional authority, the supremacy.
I'm not familiar with that case. Educate me.
Well, it's, I think, 1819. It was the first John Marshall. And it basically said that Congress has enumerated powers, but they have to defer to the Congress, which is the people, as you said.
Right.
And that typically, unless they've done something totally unconstitutional, the court should defer to the Congress. And McCulloch is the most cited case in Supreme Court history. Again, it's an early Marshall case, and he stayed away from the Commerce Clause, and he stayed with the necessary and proper provision of Article 1-8.
Right.
And he looked at the Supremacy Clause. The Commerce Clause he gave a little bit of shift to, and the General Welfare Clause or statement.
Mm-hmm.
And McCulloch is very much consistent with the conservative view in the sense that basically the authority is in there in Article 1 for Congress to extend its powers with both enumerated and implied powers.
Right.
Which are unstated.
Yes. Okay.
And Professor Tribe yesterday did predict a 6-3 victory. I didn't think that they would. I thought Kennedy was more of a surprise than Roberts.
Well, yeah, one of the things I learned this morning about Kennedy that I didn't know before is that he refers to himself as a libertarian. And so I guess it's not a surprise that Kennedy would go off on this. All you know, the, you know, this is more government because he's a small government libertarian guy. But that was apparently the case. McCullough versus what in 1819?
McCullough versus Maryland.
Maryland.
One C.
Okay, great.
I always thought that would be the critical turning point in this case.
Yeah. Well, apparently it was. And I agree with you that this, I think that not only is Roberts concerned about his legacy given some of the rulings, but I think that Scalia's rants from the bench and general demeanor and behavior may have, you know, reached some kind of critical threshold for Roberts where he's like, you know, I'm not with stupid, you know. You seen the T-shirt, you know, with the arrow pointing to the side and I'm not with stupid. And he's just like, he doesn't want to go there anymore. I mean, Scalia is, he's off the rails. I mean, yesterday I called for his impeachment. E.J. Dionne was writing in the Washington Post calling for him to resign. I agree.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So how's Romney, how are the Republicans going to play this thing other than yelling and squealing? What's their alternative? I mean, they wanted to voucherize Medicare. What are they going to do about Obamacare? Maybe the good, the bad, and the very, very acatalept. Practically Ugly, brought to you by the Organic Wine Company, 1-888 Eco Wine. The good, the Chicago City Council. Yesterday, the City Council voted 43-2 to decriminalize possession of small amounts of marijuana. And my story just vanished. Let me see here. Here we go. Those caught with 15 grams or less of marijuana will be issued a ticket. Currently, there are a number of states and cities considering decriminalization of marijuana, and 15 states and numerous cities, including Seattle and Philadelphia, have already decriminalized it. With prison overcrowding at an all-time high, thanks in large part to minor drug offenses, it's time America abandoned the failed war on drugs and finally came up with a drug policy that works and makes sense. The bad, Giles Simon. Looks like the war on women has spread to the world of sports. Earlier this week, during the famed Wimbledon tennis tournament in England, male tennis star Giles Simon said that he believes women's tennis players should be paid less than men because watching male tennis players play is, in his words, more attractive. Simon also went on to say that equal pay for men is, quote, something that doesn't work in sport, end quote. It's worth noting that tennis is the only professional sport in the world that offers equal pay for both male and female competitors. Women have come a long way in sports since Title IX, and despite what Mr. Simon may think, they deserve the same treatment and respect as men. And the very, very ugly, federal judge Robert Hinkle. Florida Governor Rick Scott can continue with his voter purge of thousands of eligible Floridian voters, or at least that's what Judge Hinkle said yesterday. Hinkle rejected the Justice Department's request for a temporary order to suspend the voter purge, and according to the Associated Press, Hinkle made his decision based on highly questionable reasoning. It also appears he ignored the federal law that states that voter purges of ineligible voters must be completed at least 90 days before a primary or general election. Once again, we have a judge who is using judicial activism to give Republicans in Florida a victory and who is blatantly disregarding federal law, and that is very, very ugly. Sounds like 2000 all over again. This is very, very ugly. Yes. So, Jay in Dunedin, how do you say it in Florida there, Jay?
Dunedin.
Oh, Dunedin, okay. So what's up?
Yeah, we're right next to Clearwater, just to give you a little heads up there.
Yep.
I've been listening to you now for about 2 weeks. Unfortunately, I'm a senior citizen. I have a TV that periodically goes out of whack simply because my satellite provider doesn't get his money on time. So and they jack up the rates all the time. But that isn't why
So Jay, what did you call about?
The first question I have is, I think there's 9 members on the Supreme Court.
Yes.
Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. The vote today was 5-3. Does that mean that...
No, it was 5-4.
Excuse me?
It was 5-4.
Oh, it was 5-4.
Yeah. The vote yesterday was 5-3. The day before yesterday was 5-3 on the Arizona case, as I recall, because Elena Kagan had argued that case before the Supreme Court as U.S. Solicitor General. So she had recused herself, but nobody recused themselves on this one. Rama in Williamstown, Vermont. Hey, Rama. What's
up? Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Good.
Hey, listen, having read a bunch of the decision there that came down on the Affordable Care Act, is I got to tell you, either one or two things happened. Somebody either directly aimed their arguments at Chief Justice Roberts, very specifically, or Chief Justice Roberts was playing a game of solo twister while he was writing his decision. My $9 billion bet is on the first choice there, because, I mean, when you read Chief Justice Roberts' decision, he blows out the Interstate Commerce Clause. He just totally blows that out of the water in his response. He blows out the Necessary and Proper Clause. But he gets to the bit about the penalty, which is such a fundamental part of the most important thing that for everybody, the mandate that we all have purchased some sort of insurance.
Right.
And he finds a very carefully crafted way to define the penalty as a tax that falls within the taxing authority of the Congress. And it's so well, I mean, it is so carefully crafted, and he has to jump through so many loopholes to get to that point that when you read it, and I really, Tom, you're a wordsmith. You will love reading this if you get the chance to. But, I mean, somebody just directed the perfect arguments to Roberts, knowing where his line of reasoning was going to take him on this.
Either that or Roberts wanted to salvage his reputation and that of his court. He was concerned that if they struck down Obamacare, that could then lead to a movement to end judicial review, that it could cause Congress to actually use its powers under Article 3, Section 2 and start, at the very least, impose the Judicial Code of Conduct on the Supreme Court.
I've got to tell you, Tom, doing a reading of that, it doesn't sound like it. This sounds like a decision.
Well, where I was going with that is that if he had those concerns, he might have said to one of his law clerks, you know, write a very eloquent decision here or something.
Well, this was a very well-crafted decision that obviously was not written the night before on, you know, not drinking coffee. So I really think that the Obama administration, whoever they had going there, somebody knew what they were doing when they were presenting in front of Roberts.
Very interesting. Okay, thanks for your theory, Rama. It's a good one. Tom in Seattle. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hi, Tom.
Yes, sir.
Tom? Yeah. I have a kind of a concern about the ruling as far as defining it, the Obamacare as a tax. And that is that now that it is defined as a tax, that Grover Norquist and his minions from Mordor are going to focus in as, you know, that's their number one target.
Well, they did before. They've always been opposed to this. You know, it has.
But I think they're going to ramp it up.
Yeah. I am increasingly less and less concerned about Grover, you know, multimillionaire K Street lobbyist Grover Norquist and his billionaire buddies. I get your concern, but I think we need to stop being reactive. We need to stop being afraid of these people. We need to start being proactive and saying, you know, this is the kind of country we want to live in, a country where people are actually free. And as Franklin Roosevelt pointed out, a necessitous man is not a free man. You are not free if you are sick and you can't get health care. Matt in Louisville, Kentucky. Hey, Matt, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I've got the proverbial chicken and egg thing here for you.
Okay.
I work in the insurance industry, and my company, 5 of the top 7 largest insurance companies in the country are our clients. So we have lots of aggregate data about their claims and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
See that in the last year, one of these companies was billed $101 billion by providers, doctors, and pharmacies and that kind of thing. And they paid $36 billion, a 36% pay rate.
Right.
So that means that their contracts are so large, you know, basically a volume discount.
Right, they're negotiating deals, yeah.
Exactly right. So, you know, so then hospitals and providers jack up prices.
Actually, let me add to that, Matt. They're not actually negotiating deals. Those, what appear to be spectacular deals for them, you know, it's not like any of their competitors are paying those prices. It's that this is the way of sticking it to the uninsured.
That's true also. So, well, my question is, so, you know, if they continue to drive up prices to, you know, compensate for the fact that they're only being paid 36% of what they bill, you know, you...
But they're not. They're being paid 100% of what they expected to get. They organize it so it looks like 36% of what they're billed, so they can basically screw people who are uninsured to give them an incentive to get insurance. There's no shortage of stories of people who have gone, you know, who don't have insurance and, you know, have a heart attack or whatever, and they go to their doctor and say, you know, what can I do? How can I negotiate this? And the doctor says, yeah, I'll give you the $50,000 surgery for $20,000. That's what I'm paid for, you know, the health insurance companies from. This is just the retail price that we post. The insurance companies basically colluded with the rest of the entire healthcare industry to take those retail prices and post them really, really high so that people would be frightened by those numbers and they would buy insurance.
Yeah, one more quick comment here. I'd like to propose a novel kindergarten-style idea here. You know, your congressman guest from a few minutes ago, you know, all the congressmen talk about across the aisle. Why is it that there's an aisle? You know, why, you know, you go to in kindergarten or in, you know, some school event or some public event, you know, they say, welcome, have a seat next to someone that you don't already know.
Well, yeah.
Why can't we do something that simple in Congress?
That's what they did, I think, for Obama's first State of the Union address, that Nancy Pelosi got together with John Boehner and said, okay, let's organize this thing so that it's Democrat, Republican, and they were not sitting in blocks. They were sitting next to each other. And, you know, it seemed to work out fairly well. You know, now that the Republicans are in control of the House of Representatives, though, they don't do that anymore. Thank you very much.
Buy each other lunch one day rather than, you know, the Koch brothers buying you lunch or something.
Yeah. It used to be that way. It used to be, you know, it was called collegiality. It used, you know, the colleagues working together, even though they're on opposite sides of the aisle, knowing each other. You talk to people who've been in this town a long time, and I've talked to a few of them. And you know, before... more than 15 years ago, before the Republicans really went nuts during the Clinton administration, basically. I mean, even during the Reagan administration, people used to know each other, and they hung out socially, Republicans and Democrats. Now they don't. Now it's like, you know, the wall of silence. It's really sad.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Or maybe it's not really sad. Maybe it's that now the real issues are coming to the fore and it's not an old boys insiders club anymore. I mean, you could play this either way.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy.
Indeed. Talk Create Media for the rest of us. Welcome back. Tom in Shreveport, Louisiana. Hey, Tom, you're on the air. What's up?
Hello, Tom. You know, I was listening to Jabba the Rush this morning. And he's already been touting for a half hour, 45 minutes about the conspiracy that Obama called him and threatened him, all these different, you know, and now he's couching it under, I don't believe this. I don't think it's true. But and then goes on for a half hour about how it's a conspiracy.
Right.
And people. And I'm a trucker, and they feed us. And every one of these truck stops, all they get is
Fox News.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
And there's nothing that a trucker loves more than a conspiracy. And I can already hear the conversation going into dinner. I can already hear about how this is, it was forced upon them. You know, they really don't want this, and we gotta, you know.
Yeah,
it's just sad. But
yeah, because you have to ask the question: what's wrong with just doing the right thing? Although John Roberts has a history of not doing the right thing, and that's what's got some people scratching their heads. But it does look to me like, you know, he intentionally did the right thing in this case, and managed to upset his own guys. So, Tom, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for the insight into the truck stops. Lloyd, a trucker in Wyoming. Hey, Lloyd, what's up?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Hi there. Tom, I don't think Robert is worried about his reputation because the winner's right history, and he expects to keep on winning. The same way that the right doesn't overturn Roe v. Wade, which they could do whenever they want to, and the reason they didn't get Bin Laden is they want to have wedge issues. I think this has been done to get up support in the fall for the voters that they're going to lose over their gay issues and things like that. I think this is done cynically to get up support in the fall.
Yeah, so you think that Roberts ruled, you know, was the wild swing vote on this thing and ruled to keep Obamacare because it's going to so upset the Republican base that they're going to turn out in November?
It adds to the other disparate groups that they bring in, and put together a election group. So, yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Well, it's not inconceivable, and that might be, I mean, you know, very often these guys are playing chess and not checkers. It makes perfect sense. George in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Hey, George, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Well, I was kind of disappointed that they didn't overturn it, but not for any of the things that are in there about health care. I think every one of those issues need to be addressed and taken care of, and I'm good, you know, that's the good part of it. I think that the reason they need to change Obamacare or the Affordable Health Care Act, whatever you want to call it, is the rest of what's in there. And there's about 18 middle-class taxes that are in that bill. And, for example, if you sell your house on January 1st, 2013, you're going to pay a 3% federal sales tax to go to help pay for this.
George, do you make over $250,000 a year?
Pardon me?
Do you make over $250,000 a year?
I don't think that's on everybody, Tom. This is what
No, no, George. George, somebody has lied to you, George. George, somebody has lied to you. That tax only applies if you earn over $250,000 a year, and it only applies on capital gains. Now, people who take their income in the form of capital gains, I mean, occasionally it happens that you sell a house and you make a capital gain, but typically it's the guys who work on Wall Street. Mitt Romney, all of his income is capital. Let me finish my sentence here, George. Hold off. Mitt Romney makes all his money. He made $23 million in capital gains. He paid a maximum 15% income tax. He will pay an additional 3% because he makes more than $250,000 on his capital gains. You're right on that. But anybody who makes under $250,000 a year is absolutely unaffected by these. There are no middle class tax increases in Obamacare. None. The people who are telling you that are lying to you. And what you should ask them is, please show me where in the bill that occurs.
Well, what about the $500 billion out of Medicare? That's everybody.
No, there is no $500 billion out of Medicare. There is Medicare, and there is Medicare Advantage. Medicare Advantage is a hole that got drilled into Medicare by Republicans during the Reagan administration, where they said, we got to figure out, this Medicare thing is really cool. We got to figure out a way that the health insurance companies can get a piece of the action here. Because Medicare is only making 3%, or, you know, that's their overhead. But the health insurance companies, they want to make 20, 30%. And so how can we do this? So they created this Medicare Advantage thing that would fill in some of the gaps of Medicare. They put the gaps in there in the first place, right? And then they said, okay, Medicare Advantage will fill in the gaps. And the biggest provider of Medicare Advantage in the United States is UnitedHealthcare, who has paid their last two CEOs over $1 billion, $1,000 million in compensation just to the CEOs because they make all this money. All the Medicare Advantage plans through AARP are via UnitedHealthcare. So what Obamacare does is it says, instead of running that Medicare Advantage stuff through these for-profit health insurance companies, who over the next decade are going to make $500 billion in profits off this, instead of running it through them, we're going to run it through regular Medicare, where there's only 3% government overhead. So all the people save money except for the health insurance companies. Medicare itself is not being cut at all. Medicare Advantage is losing customers to Medicare. Again, you've been lied to, George.
Well, I don't know about that. I know that.
No,
I'm
telling you.
I live in Nebraska. I know that I live in Nebraska, Tom, and I'm a Republican, but I voted for Ben Nelson 6 years ago.
Yeah.
Ben Nelson can't run for re-election because he was the deciding vote in this, and he told the people out there that, first of all, it wouldn't pass, and he wouldn't vote for it, but he had to vote for it because it was, and this was reported on the news, that they would close Offutt Air Force Base, which is where SAC is, if he didn't.
Yeah.
And that was on the local news, Tom. It was on the local news in Omaha. Okay.
I don't care, George. That's got, you know, Ben Nelson's weirdnesses have nothing to do with whether there's a middle class tax in this bill. There isn't. There is no cut to Medicare. There is a cut to Medicare Advantage that is made up for by moving money into Medicare. The people who get hurt are not you or me or grandma. It's the CEO of United Healthcare. And that, in my mind, is a good thing. George, thanks a lot for the call. Tomorrow, Friday, Brunch with Bernie. We'll check out what Senator Bernie Sanders has to say about this. And, of course, in our national town hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie, your chance to talk to a United States senator and ask him your questions. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, tag. You're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.